7-time Grammy winner Prince, who was known for mega hits like When Doves Cry, Let's Go Crazy, and Purple Rain, has died at the age of 57. What a tragedy. Prince was found dead in the elevator of his Paisley Park estate in Minnesota. Deputies and medical personnel found the music icon unresponsive. When they arrived at his home, they performed CPR. It was obviously unsuccessful. He was pronounced dead at 10:07 a.m. A transcript of the 911 call from Prince's suburban Minneapolis compound shows confusion as an unidentified caller struggles to give the dispatcher even the proper address. TMZ is reporting tonight that Prince was treated for a drug overdose 6 days before his death. You might recall the story of Prince's private jet making an emergency landing in Moline, Illinois last Friday, hours after he performed in Atlanta. At the time, his rep said he was battling the flu, something questioned by TMZ because his plane was only 48 minutes from home before the unscheduled landing. Multiple sources in Moline tell TMZ that Prince was rushed to a hospital and doctors gave him a save shot, typically administered to counteract the effects of an opiate. Other sources further say doctors advised Prince to stay in the hospital for 24 hours. His people demanded a private room, and when they were told that was not possible, Prince and company decided to leave the hospital. The singer was released 3 hours after arriving and flew home. TMZ is told Prince left. He was not doing well. They say authorities in Minnesota are trying to get the hospital records from Moline to help determine the cause of death. TMZ has made more than a dozen attempts to reach Prince's reps for comment. They went radio silent. Later on tonight, R. Gary Patterson will join us as we will talk about the untimely death of Prince at the age of 57, considered still young for what he did. We'll also talk about the Club of 27, so many great rock musicians who have died at that age of 27. And former WWE superstar Joni Lohrer, also known as China, has died at the age of 45. The immediate cause of death was unknown. The Los Angeles County Department of Medical Examiner coroner said she was found dead in her Redondo Beach, California home Wednesday afternoon. But someone very much alive, Queen Elizabeth II, celebrated her 90th birthday. It was a short walk to greet well-wishers and a family party. She stayed at home with her dogs as the nation paid tribute to her service and her stamina. The FBI paid a non-governmental third party more than $1 million for technology that allowed the agency to unlock an iPhone 5C that belonged to that San Bernardino gunman, Syed Farouk, according to a remark made by the FBI Director James Comey at a moderated discussion in London. And Jerry Corsi, of course, who writes for WND, noted author as well, and also one of his books, Atomic Iran. Jerry, I wanted to do a quick round robin with you about what's going on around this planet these days, but $1 million to unlock the phone, was that worth it? What do you think?
Well, George, it's a lot, and I'm wondering if there couldn't have been a way the FBI might have gotten experts to unlock that phone a lot cheaper. I mean, it seems like an exorbitant price to pay. And, of course, the issue of secrecy is important, but, you know, so is the issue of law enforcement and the need to unlock these phones. So it's a difficult question to answer. I mean, in terms of the survey and news, I was really disappointed that President Obama in Saudi Arabia did not press for the release of these pages in the 9/11 reports that remain suppressed on Saudi Arabia's involvement in the 9/11 attack. I thought that was really a opportunity we had to get some truth that was bypassed.
Jerry, I'm sensing some tensions between Russia and the United States these days. Are you feeling that too?
Well, certainly, George, when Russia, with impunity, is having warships buzz our Navy vessels and acting as if you know, the United States takes any action to counter that with rules of engagement that might consider that a hostile act, that Russia would be reacting in accord also in a hostile fashion. I mean, these are kind of aggressive acts that I can't ever remember Russian airplanes doing. in the history even of the Cold War. And yet the Obama administration is not taking action against it. We're not really even registering protest with the Russian aggressive acts of their military around the world.
No, it's very strange. And lastly, let me get your reaction, of course, to the primaries and your thoughts on just how they're going right now.
Well, I mean, it's very interesting. In both races, we have the challengers who are outsiders, Bernie Sanders, who continues, and I think is going to continue right to the end, is not going to drop out, is representing a serious challenge to Hillary Clinton. And Donald Trump, well, it's still questionable whether he might get the 1,237 delegates needed for first ballot win. It's going to come very close and is clearly the front runner in a GOP primary contest where the GOP establishment is really loath to have Donald Trump succeed as he is. So it's a very, very interesting year of the outsiders.
All right, Jerry, you take care. Let's keep in touch. A judge says an agreement with Volkswagen offering now to buy back, compensate diesel owners. It will give consumers who bought nearly 600,000 Volkswagen vehicles that they rigged to cheat on emissions the option of having the automaker buy back the cars or simply fix them. That's a huge story there. Since Americans first heard the term global warming in the 1970s, the weather has actually improved for most people living in the U.S., but it won't always be that way, according to a new study. Research shows Americans typically like warmer winters and dislike hot summers, humid summers, and they reveal their weather preferences by moving to areas with conditions they like the best. And a new study in the journal Nature has found that 80% of the U.S. population lives in counties experiencing more pleasant weather than they did 40 years ago. But what does this all mean? Let's check in with Dr. Tim Ball, the renowned environmental consultant. Tim, tell me a little bit about your thoughts on this.
Well, what's going on here, of course, is that people always move to the ideal climates. One of the problems you've got in the U.S. is that the great migration from the east and northeast to the southwest, and that's been going on for a long time. It isn't just economy, it's climate. And, of course, you get these snowbirds, the people from the north that fly to Florida for the winter and so on. So it's an interesting question in that Al Gore said, you know, the global temperature is just right. He did the Goldilocks thing. But, of course, that's a matter of your personal tastes. I mean, I can tell you, having flown in the Arctic, that the Eskimo people hated coming south. They found it too hot. But, of course, most of Americans are middle-latitude people and look for that ideal climate. And the ideal climate, by the way, globally, is generally conceded to be what's called a Mediterranean climate. That is the California climate, which is cooler, wet winters and hot, dry summers. And so you got places like the southern part of Africa, South Africa, the California coast, the Mediterranean, obviously, and those are considered to be the ideal climate.
Tim, with respect to some people talking about a mini ice age, what's your take on that?
Well, of course, what's happening is the sun has reached a peak, and it's now in activity that we haven't seen for 10,000 years. There's no doubt that the trend of the sun is going to be for cooling, and many of us have been predicting much cooler weather over the next 30, 40 years, a mini ice age. The problem is that the government have focused totally on warming, and in fact, they narrowed the focus by their definition of climate change. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change only looked at human causes of global warming, but they also only studied the costs of warming. So what they were doing was like doing an economic cost-benefit study, but only looking at the cost. They never looked at the benefits of warming. And the benefits of warming far outweigh the costs of a cooler world. And you mentioned earlier about the 1970s. Well, at that time, the concern was global cooling. The world had been cooling from 1940 through to about 1980. And the CIA were producing reports showing the real danger of a cooler world on food production, social unrest, and so on.
That's right.
So what you've got here is government interference, government trying to create a premeditated result with the result that they focused on completely the wrong things.
Thank you. That's Dr. Tim Ball. Authorities in Poland say a baby boy has gone home safe well after his brain-dead mother was kept alive on life support so he could be born. Doctors at the university hospital kept the mother alive for 55 days while they waited for the boy to grow. The 41-year-old mother was taken to the hospital 17 weeks into the pregnancy with an incurable brain tumor. Her life support has been switched off. Doctors delivered the baby when they judged the boy's life was in danger. Man, what a story. Up next, Matt Stein back with us, author of When Technology Fails and When Disaster Strikes as well, two separate books, as we talk about preparedness and some other stories that, well, just may chill you next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Matt Stein back with us. He's a design engineer, green builder, author of two best-selling books. I mentioned the titles there, When Technology Fails, When Disaster Strikes as well. He is an active mountain climber as well, loves the outside, and is very well prepared for just about anything that happens. And we're going to be talking with him about all kinds of issues that affect us. Matt, welcome back. It's good to have you.
George, always a pleasure to be on Coast to Coast. Thanks so much for having me back on.
You know, I'm so concerned, Matt, about the Fukushima spillout of radiation that I am convinced is hitting the west coast of the United States. What are you hearing anything about that?
Well, it is hitting the west coast. I honestly don't think it's hitting us really hard. But what really, really concerns me is it's far worse in Japan and for the Japanese people than the media is letting on. And a big part of that is that the Abe government has a gag order. They basically say that if somebody spills, quote, government secrets, then they can go to jail. So the doctors who treat people at Fukushima, in the Fukushima district, for radiation poisoning, if they say radiation poisoning, they don't get paid. And several clinics have gone bankrupt because they were treating people and saying the cause of their illness is radiation, and the government refuses to pay if anybody says that it's radiation. They have to make up some bogus diagnosis that's totally false if they want to get paid. So what the government is doing is they're suppressing any information which is showing how bad the health effects are, how bad the radiation is, how totally worthless their billion-dollar cleanup efforts are, and anyone who spills the beans on how bad it's going as far as the cleanup and as far as the safety of Fukushima. Basically, anybody who's telling the truth risks going to jail there. And they've shut down people, they've shut down journalists, they're putting people in jail. So the real truth of how bad it truly is being totally covered up in Japan, and the people are terrified. It turns out that nearly 100% of the women in Japan are totally against nuclear power and restarting any of these reactors, and over 50% of the men are. So three-quarters of the civilian population is totally against this, but the banks are putting so much pressure on the government.
The banks are?
The banks are, because what that is all of these, they shuttered. They had nearly 50 reactors going at the time of Fukushima accident, and they've shuttered all those reactors. They've restarted something like four, and so the banks have been paying the salaries for all of these people who've been idled for the last 5 years now. And the only way they're going to get their money back from these, the investments in these nuclear reactors is to get them restarted. So there's a huge financial pressure to get business as usual going again, get these restarted again. But the people are terrified. And the truth of the matter is that young children, the death rates in young children around Fukushima, in the refugees from Fukushima, have skyrocketed. And all kinds of people are being treated for chronic fatigue and this and that, and it's radiation poisoning. So the truth of the matter is that the The health effects are horrendous, but we'll never know how bad they are because the government is obliterating any long-term medical records, and they're also causing people to falsify those records if they want to get paid.
Why are they trying to hide all this, Matt? What are they afraid of?
They're afraid. This is devastating the economy, and they want to get things back to going business as usual. They have billions and billions of dollars invested in these nuclear power plants, and they're all basically junk that are going to cost like $5 billion a piece to shut down and dismantle. So it's a huge economic toilet flush that's taking the country down, and the Abe government is, the former prime minister, or whatever they call the lead of the government, he was very pro-nuclear until Fukushima, and he's totally against it now. And I have a personal friend of mine, Arne Gundersen, who's a nuclear whistleblower, who was number one in his class at RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, a very prestigious technical university in the East Coast. He was number one in his class in nuclear engineering. He was being flown around by Forbes private jet all over the country when he helped arrange the sale and purchase of the very last nuclear power plant to be built in the 70s and 80s in the United States. And he was a firm believer in nuclear energy until his eyes got opened by seeing unsafe practices, which he reported. And his wife said, "You know, Arnie, are you prepared to lose your job over this?" And he said, I can't. You know, I have to report this. This is a serious, unsafe storage of nuclear materials." He says, "I'm duty bound to report this. You know, it's like my career if I don't report it." And she says, "No, Arnie, I think you're going to lose your career if you do report it." And, you know, he followed his conscience. He did what he felt he was legally bound to do. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry rewarded him with a slap lawsuit, and it bankrupted him. He and his wife lost everything. They lost their retirement. They lost their home on 24 acres. They lost every penny they had, and the nuclear industry made sure he would never work within the industry again. You know, and he was still a firm believer in the nuclear industry for several years until, you know, even in the beginning of Three Mile Island, he still believed in the industry. But as he uncovered more and more dirt in the industry, his eyes got opened, and he became a top, you know, fighter against the nuclear industry because he's the guy who really knows, and he's a personal friend of mine, and so I worked with him a lot on these issues. He's helped to educate me when I was writing my article 400 Chernobyls on the danger of massive nuclear meltdowns due to either an EMP, a terrorist EMP, electromagnetic pulse from a high-altitude nuclear
device. Or some kind of cyber attack?
Yeah, or a cyber attack, or a solar storm, which is a natural reoccurring event. They happen about once every 80 years, extreme solar storms.
And we dodged one a few years ago. We were lucky.
We were really close. In 2012, I believe, we were 2 weeks away. In other words, this massive solar storm came off the sun, even bigger than the Carrington event, which is a 1 in 500-year event. So more than twice the size of the 1921 event, which was the last extreme solar storm. And it intersected the Earth's orbit where the Earth had been 2 weeks earlier. So if it had happened 2 weeks earlier,
goodbye grid,
it would have been the end of the world as we know it. And we just dodged that bullet by sheer luck that, you know, it came across our orbit a little ways away, 2 weeks away from where we'd been in that orbit. And if that had hit us, it would have been curtains for most of the world, and maybe for mammalian life, because the chain of events that it would have started would have probably killed at least 90% of the population of the United States, according to the EMP Commission.
That's right.
That's not including nuclear power plants melting down Fukushima style. And there's a guarantee if we have a terrorist EMP that we'll lose nuclear power plants. But with a solar storm, it's an if. But it's a pretty strong if that chances, if it's a really severe storm, is that the aftermath of the storm will be so devastating to the economy and to everything, will be shut down, that the chances of them keeping the cooling systems going for a couple of years till things get back to normal is pretty slim.
So, Matt, let's talk about that possibility when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your preparedness questions and your questions with Matt Stein next hour. I've got so much to talk with him about when we come back in just a moment. And welcome back to Coast. Matt Stein is with us, author of When Technology Fails and also When Disaster Strikes, when both of these things could happen, too. Matt, how many nuclear power plants do we have in the United States now online?
I think there's something like 99 now. There was 104 a few years ago, but the San Onofre plants have gone offline, and the Vermont Yankee plant's gone offline, and I think there's another one that went offline, too. So I think we're down to 99 from 104.
And when you say went offline, they're not being used, what happened to them? They just outdated them and shut them down, or what?
Yeah, well, you know, you got a very expensive piece of something that's going to be radioactive for, you know, another 250, another quarter million years. So you got a really expensive big hump of something that you don't really know exactly what to do with. You know, the cost, for instance, the cost of supposedly for decommissioning the San Onofre plants in California is $5 billion. And these plants were originally designed for a 40-year lifespan. And in San Onofre, they lasted 24 years. The first unit lasted 24 years, not exactly 40 years. And the second and third units were dead at like 42 years now. So they spent almost $1 billion about 5 years ago redoing the steam generators because they were failing.
Jeez.
And they were planning on getting another 20 years out of them. And after a couple of years, they found they found some really serious radioactive gas leaks out of the steam generators. And they went in and inspected them with X-rays, and they found that there's some kind of weird dynamic vibration problem that was causing them to corrode extremely fast. So things that were supposed to last another 20 years were dead after like 2 years. So instead of fixing the plant again, spending another $1 billion, they decided to just decommission them, that they were old anyways. So they just decided that it's time to shut these plants down. So in Vermont Yankee, similarly, had just been approved a couple years ago or 5 years ago now. It's been shut for a couple of years. But like in 2010, they approved it for another 20 years. So it had reached its 40-year life cycle. That was what they were originally projected, and they were inspected it and said, yeah, everything's cool, this is great, and they gave it another 20 years on top to allow it to operate for 60 years. Well, it started leaking really, really badly. They discovered really high-level radiation releases into the water table, and there was a big upcry in Vermont of the people, except for the people whose livelihoods depended on the plant. Most everybody else in Vermont, you know, didn't want that radioactive waste going on
right.
in an aging plant. So they decided the state forced them to shut down, even though they had the NRC gave them another, they had 18 more years that they could operate on their license from the NRC. The state forced them to shut down. So when these things shut down, they have a couple of years where they hire a lot of people to kind of slowly shut it down and unload the fuels, and then they've got the problems of what do they do with the fuels, because we have no permanent fuel repository. There's no Yucca Mountain repository. So it's still kind of one of these things where, you know, 50 years ago they said, we're going to solve this problem of nuclear waste, and 50 years later they still haven't solved this problem of nuclear waste. So it's a really big, giant problem that takes about $5 billion to, quote, clean up, but it's not really clean then, because then you have these canisters. Each one of these giant canisters has more cesium than was released, radioactive cesium than was released in Chernobyl.
Jeez,
and
that's frightening.
And you got these things sitting around. Basically, in a single year of a nuclear reactor operating, you produce about as much stuff as, like, I think it's something like 1,000 nuclear bombs. Let me see. I've got the number right.
And while you're looking for that, Matt, it's not a matter of if, but when we're going to have a meltdown issue in the United States, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. Here it is, 500 bombs. It's not a matter of if but when. And that's what really frightens me, is that already we've had a number of close calls where we nearly had a Fukushima-like disaster in the United States. So do you remember back in 2011 when the Mississippi River was having that massive flooding issue? I mean, just it was at record, you know, way above.
Well, there was one definitely in 1993. I was here. In
2011 was even worse. That was one where there was pictures of the nuclear power plant, and it was a plant that was just north of, it was in Nebraska, and it was at some fort in Nebraska, and it was surrounded by sandbags on these walls that were designed to, floodgates that were designed to keep the water out.
Sandbags don't do much,
and they were the only thing that kept it from flooding. What people don't realize is that those sandbags were stacked upon these flood walls and floodgates that had been installed 6 months earlier, the summer before. If they had not said, hey, you know, we need better flood protection at this plant, and let's build this, like, flood wall around it and these floodgates around it, if that had not been built
the summer before,
then that plant would have gone up Fukushima style.
Oh, wow.
In America. And I think it was like 20 miles north of Omaha. And only 20 miles away. And that would have been our very own Fukushima on our soil if they had not installed those flood walls. And as it was, they had to extend the tops of those flood walls with sandbags. Not exactly. I mean, anytime you see a stack of sandbags that's the only thing that's preventing a nuclear power plant from melting down and poisoning a big chunk of America,
you're in trouble.
That's a pretty scary thing.
Yeah.
And the fact that that has already happened on our soil, and we just missed it. And there was no earthquakes, there was no hurricane, you know, there was no terrorist act. This was just a severe flood. And you know, we're seeing the climate's getting more crazy in our world. We're seeing, you know, hotter. I mean, right now you're seeing people dropping dead like flies in India from the heat waves, and in Pakistan, and you're seeing, you know, crops drying up, and in other parts of the world you're seeing massive floods. I mean, the floods in England they have structures in England that go back well over 1,000 years, and the floods this winter were way above any flood lines that have been there since those structures were built well over 1,000 years ago. So we're definitely seeing swings in weathers that we've just never seen before in as far as modern man has been on the planet. And so here we have this 99 nuclear power plants still operating in America. Many of them, like Vermont Yankee, much, you know, older than their original design life, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in many of these cases, is extending their license so they can operate another 20 years past their original design life. So we're seeing these aging structures, and we're seeing that combined with, you know, environmental situations that they were never designed to see before. So, for instance, outside of the Diablo Canyon plant, the last remaining nuclear power plant in California, Diablo Canyon, there was a PhD working there, you know, for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and he identified a seismic fault line just 300 yards away from the plant offshore that hadn't been identified before, and said, look, this plant is not designed to withstand the level of earthquake that this new fault line, that newly discovered fault line, could produce. And, you know, this is serious. And as is the case with pretty much all these times that a serious flaw is being found and being reported, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the power plant people get together and basically say, well, you know, we're still okay. Don't worry about it. Keep operating that nuclear power plant. Like, you know, everything's okay. Arnie was saying, when you get inside these plants, they're so massive, and the walls are so thick, and there's so much steel, you just kind of get blown away by it and think, like, these things can't fail. I mean, you know, look at all they've designed into this. But the truth of the matter is, in the last 50 years, we've had or we've had, or the last 70 years, we've had an last 35 years since Three Mile Island, we have had 5 major nuclear failures. We've had.
They've kept that pretty quiet,
haven't they? Three Mile Island, we've had Chernobyl, and we had 3 different huge meltdowns at Fukushima. So we've averaged 1 every 7 years in the last 35 years. Now, the nuclear industry sold the governments in the world on how safe these power plants were. They sold the governments in the world saying that it's a 1 in a million year, 1 in every million years of operation, we have, you know, the chances are that we'll have 1 serious failure in a million years of operation. Well, we've had 35 years with 5 serious failures. Now, granted, so if you do the math and say, well, these are reactor years, it's a little confusing, and there's 440 reactors roughly in the world, they were still off by a factor of 350-1 in terms of estimating how safe these were. Now, if you went to a bookie and he gave you like 2-1 odds, and you know you placed your bet, and then you found out that it was actually 2-700 odds, I'd be kind of pissed off. You know, it's like, oh, the bookie told me it was these odds, but actually my odds, you know, the odds were 350 times worse than what, you know, on what I was betting on, or whether it's a lottery or a bookie or something like that. And the nuclear industry sold the world on how safe these things were based on their theoretical calculations, but the reality of the truth of their track record is they were off by a factor of 350-1.
Matt, do you think our elected officials know we're sitting on time bombs?
I think some of them do, but most of them don't, because it's kind of hard to go to sleep at night. Because when you consider the fact that 37% of the population of the United States lives within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant.
Oh, and how many of these plants are on earthquake faults?
Well, there's about 12 of them, you know, on the fault in the off the Mississippi River.
New Madrid Fault.
The New Madrid Fault. There's about 12 of these nuclear power plants that would probably be seriously affected, you know, possibly along the lines of Fukushima, by the New Madrid going off. Diablo Canyon is certainly on a fault. We're seeing with fracking, we're seeing lots of faults waking up, places like Oklahoma having, you know, significant earthquakes that they've, like, not had in modern history. You're seeing, you know, in the Northeast, there's been some major earthquakes back in the 1800s and 1700s off of Nova Scotia and outside of Boston, and they just don't happen as often as the ones in California. So people tend to be complacent and think it can't happen here because, you know, it didn't happen in their time or their grandparents' time or their great-grandparents' time. But, you know, it certainly happened in the Thomas Jefferson's time, and according to seismologists, Boston is overdue for a major quake.
Oh,
and, you know, so these kinds of things, it's more, what I'm more worried about in most places is not, I mean, New Madrid, I'm worried about quakes. In most places, I'm worried about extreme storms. Think of Hurricane Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
Hurricane Sandy had a major, like on a nuclear power plant. The storm surge could do a lot, you know, pretty much similar to some of these power plants that are operating on coastal areas. It could do something very similar to what happened at Fukushima, you know, only it'd be a hurricane storm surge instead of a tidal wave surge. So, you know, these things are happening. Super typhoons are hitting the Philippines, a lot of tropical places like they've never seen before. And, you know, Hurricane Sandy was an example of an extreme storm hitting the East Coast, whether it's a global climate change or just the luck of the draw and the dice, you know, roll of the dice, I can't tell you on that one.
Matt, as we look at this situation, is it fixable by anyone? I mean, can we truly fix this so we can avert a disaster that will eventually happen?
Well, it's totally fixable. And the technology right now, today I read a report that said that the UK could be 100% carbon-free converting to renewables in a decade. Germany has shuttered their power plants and created hundreds of thousands of jobs by saying we're going to go renewables. We're going to get away from nuclear. We're going to get away from, you know, coal and oil. we're changing the climate of the planet. We're messing things up, and we're going to commit to do the right thing. So we could do that in America. The Abe government in Japan could have taken the opportunity presented by Fukushima to say, you know, we're going to make jobs, and we're going to keep these nuclear power plants shuttered for good, and we're going to do the right thing for our people and for the planet, and we're going to make lots of jobs by switching to renewables. And yes, it's going to cause some economic havoc in the nuclear industry and in the utilities based on nuclear. But you know, let's do the right thing, and the government can work to make that pain not so bad, so that you know everything keeps working and the utilities don't collapse.
I wonder what the home values are like living next to nuke plants.
Well,
it's got to be low,
in Japan,
right?
They're terrible. And the home, there's many areas around Fukushima that will never be re-inhabited. Arnie was just touring Japan, and he took swabs. They went through these zones where people have been evacuated, and the Abe government is trying to move. They've done a big cleanup operation, and what they've done is they've got these bags that have a ton in each. They've got like a million bags. Giant bags, like giant garbage bags with a ton of radioactive material in each. They've been cleaning up like 20 feet on each side of the roads and stuff. You know, in this cleanup effort, you think, oh, they got to clean everything up. Well, actually, they're not. So Arnie went back through the area with radiation suits on and respirators and, you know, full suits, and they took swabs, and they found that the areas that have been already cleaned are just as radioactive as the areas that haven't been cleaned, because the wind is carrying the dust. As soon as they clean an area, a couple months later, the dust has been blown from the woods and the surrounding area back into it and recontaminated it. And yet the Abe government is forcing people. They've been supporting people who were evacuated out, and some of those people, they're giving them money to buy homes in other areas, and it makes the people in the other areas very angry that the government's just giving them a new home. You know, these people get a new home and we don't, that kind of thing. But then others, they're saying, if you want to continue getting your check from the government every month, you must move back into your homes. And some people are doing it, and some people are saying, no way, I'd rather, you know, I'm going to die.
Give up the check before they go back.
Yes. So it's tearing people apart, and it's the truth of the data that they've been taking, the people who've gone back into these areas, is that the cleanup's not working. That the, you know, the wind and the rain is just bringing the radioactive stuff. It's swirling it all around. So
well, never. Look what happened at Times Beach in Missouri, Matt, back in 1983, where they decimated this little city because they, you know, oiled down the sand with dioxin, thinking that they were doing the right thing,
right,
you know, keeping the dust down and stuff. So they'd spray dioxin that was in the oil all over the place. They ruined the city. They had to evacuate it. It's empty. It's a ghost town. It's a park now. Who would want to go to that?
Right. Well, at least in, like, Chernobyl, they've said these are dead zones. They're never going back, and they resettled the people. In Japan, what they do is they've been raising the level, the quote safe level.
They want people to move back.
What they're considering safe now, the government has officially raised the level, is a level that in the United States would require that you wear a dosimeter and that you must wear a suit and a respirator in your own.
Oh, what a way to live, Matt. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about preparedness on Coast to Coast AM.